Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 249. Today's guest is Dr. John Hallgren, a board-certified family physician and fellow of the American Academy of Family Physicians. We will be discussing engaging your family physician in the early days of your infertility journey. You can find Dr. Hallgren online at www.missiondirectprimarycare.com. And as always, don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus249. Take a listen. Hi, Dr. Hallgren. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'd like to start by hearing a little bit about you. Tell us about your academic background and training.
Well, sure. Academic background, I'm a product of public high schools in Fort Worth, Texas. And after that, I went to the U.S. Air Force Academy. Not everybody's first choice for pre-medical training. I was a product of my third generation Air Force and thought I might want to be a pilot when I went to college. So I went to the Air Force Academy, fantastic education, really rigorous academics, and certainly prepared me well for the prerequisites of medical school. Finished up there and ultimately decided that I would pursue medical school and applied to several places, got into a few, but chose the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. Are you familiar?
Yes.
Okay, because it's just up the road from you, I think. A great opportunity because it's, again, it's kind of like going to one of the service academies in that tuition is paid and you're paid actually for your participation in the program, which is a wonderful financial benefit. You have a long commitment to the Air Force after that, but I was excited about doing a full career anyway, so that was not an inhibitor for me. But again, a great school, traditional allopathic medical training, so I came out with a MD degree. Thought I wanted to go into internal medicine for a long time, but kind of late in my third year, early fourth year, I changed and decided to do family medicine and was trained, again, right up the road from you in Waldorf at Malcolm Grow Medical Center at Andrews Air Force Base. Again, a great training program. 3 years is a typical family medicine residency, and we had a fantastic traditional rotating internship. So again, really rigorous, lots of long hours, but excellent supervision and great training. And then another 2 years of finishing up to be eligible to sit for family medicine boards. And then I did some finishing work after several years later, did a faculty development fellowship at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
I was going to say, you're not still in the area by me, are you?
No, I live in Omaha, Nebraska now.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't check where you were located right before the interview, but my husband actually works at Bowling up in D.C.
Okay, yeah.
You might be familiar with that.
I am indeed.
So why did you choose a career in medicine? And yeah, I'd love to hear more about why you chose the specific path you did to get there.
I adjusted my path more than chose it. For a long time, I had an interest in medicine. I read the James Herriot veterinarian books when I was in early middle school, if you're familiar with those. They're a fantastic set of books about veterinary life in Yorkshire. And that kind of sparked my interest in doing medicine and thought I wanted to be a vet for a while. That gradually morphed into being a human doctor. But I had this tradition of a family in the Air Force, and that was compelling to me as well. My dad had been a career pilot, and that, you know, that's an exciting career too. So it was a difficult decision. Once I got to the Air Force Academy, I made sure that I majored in something that would meet all the prerequisites for admission to medical school, which was chemistry, and enjoyed that as far as it went. My senior year, the Air Force was making some big personnel decisions and was sending us all to all the pilot qualified folks to pilot training, but then not guaranteeing a flying job afterwards. And I talked to my dad and my grandfather about it, and they said, you know, this is big Air Force. If there's a flying job for you, they'll put you in it. And if there's not a flying job for you, they won't, and they'll put you where they need you. And so taking all those things together, I thought, well, I really want to do medicine too. And so I just chose that right off the bat. It's interesting. For the first years of medical school, I thought I made the worst decision of my life because I was talking to my friends who were in pilot training and flying fast jets around the world. And I'm still sitting in lecture halls learning about the Krebs cycle and naming bones. But fortunately, when I got to third year medical school, when you start your clinical rotations, all of a sudden things made sense. I was absolutely loved every bit of that. And so ultimately made the right decision.
Take us through your career then and how you ended up where you are now.
Well, after medical school, like I said, I went to residency in Camp Springs. Once you graduate, you don't have a whole lot of choice of where you go. My first assignment out of residency was to an Air Force base called Tinker, which is in Oklahoma City, and they had just closed their hospital there. Went, and it was a good job. It was a pretty relatively easy, particularly after residency job, very regular hours, and overall really good job. But I wasn't doing full spectrum family medicine, so I wasn't admitting to the hospital. I wasn't delivering babies. I wasn't doing a lot of procedural stuff that I like to do. So you have some influence in your assignments in the Air Force. I worked with my commander and was able to get an assignment to Germany after the 2 years at Tinker. My wife still doesn't forgive me for that because things got interesting in Germany. But we were stationed at Landstuhl. That's the big American Medical Center just outside of Ramstein. And so that's where all the casualties began coming back once the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq started. So we were there actually when September 11th happened. And before that, we were there when the USS Cole was bombed. So my first introduction to combat casualty care was that. It was an all-hands-on-deck affair where we had 30-some-odd people come in from the USS Cole, some of whom were still fairly seriously injured. And I ended up having to put in a chest tube in a guy who had an unrecognized collapsed lung from that. This was 2 days after a day and a half after the attack. And then September 11th was a big change for us, obviously. And we started to get ready to admit casualties from initially Afghanistan. And then after the war in Iraq started, do that. That was a fascinating, pretty profound experience for everybody involved, obviously. And so Germany was a very, very busy time. And I was doing full spectrum care at that point. So I was delivering babies. I was admitting to the hospital. Very, very intense time of my career, but really rewarding as well. After that, 3 year stint in Eglin Air Force Base, which is on the northwest coast of Florida, just outside Pensacola. And there I joined a faculty for a residency program and was faculty. USUS was the sponsoring at the Uniformed Services University, where I went to medical school, was the sponsoring academic institution, and then had the training program there. Great place to work, again, doing full spectrum family medicine, which I really loved. Did that for 3 years and then off to England for 3 years. That was a gem of an assignment, kind of the opposite of Landstuhl in many ways. I was basically the small town doc for this small base in northern England. We lived on the economy in England. Our kids went to school, English schools. We were really integrated in the community there. Really, really fun assignment. And then back here to Omaha for another 5 years of teaching with a residency that is combined with the University of Nebraska here. So Air Force and civilian residents working together in Air Force and civilian staff. Eye-opening experience, really enjoyed being part of the civilian community of medicine, which I had not really been exposed to before. And then my final 3 years, I moved into a command position. So I was in charge of our 250-person medical operations squadron. So just making sure all the doctors, nurses, and techs showed up to execute the medical care that needed for the day. And then I retired from the Air Force. So that was actually 30 years total there, including the academy and USUS. I had been following this model called direct primary care for a couple of years. It's a model where you don't take insurance, you pay a flat monthly fee for all the medical care that the clinic does. And I thought it sounded like a fairly compelling way of practicing. So I found a practice in Colorado out in Grand Junction doing this model, went out there and practiced in that model for 2 years. Loved it. It was everything I'd hoped it would be. But to my wife and I, it was a great surprise. I'm originally from Texas for the most part, and she's originally from Florida. But I guess 8 years in one place makes it feel like home for us. And so we felt like we needed to move back to Omaha. Moved back here, and then we opened our own practice, which is called Mission Direct Primary Care here, operating on a direct primary care basis.
What exactly is primary care for people who are not familiar, and what are family physicians trained to do?
Yeah, great question. Primary care encompasses primarily three different specialties. So family medicine, pediatrics, and general internal medicine are traditionally considered the primary care specialties. And the best way I think to think of it is that is always your entry point into professional medical care by a physician. A lot of times, or physician extender, physician assistant, or nurse practitioner. And they're going to be assessing wellness aspects, preventive aspects, so immunizations, cancer screenings, those types of things. And the big thing that we do is differentiating the undifferentiated primary care complaint. If you have a sore knee and you don't know why, you have a respiratory illness and you don't know why, you know, our job is to figure out what the diagnosis is. And if we can't figure it out in a pretty timely manner, that then refer on to specialties. And then we all get a pretty significant amount of training in common chronic disease management. So asthma, diabetes, thyroid disorders, lots of common, like I said, chronic diseases will be managed in primary care. And only if it gets to where, you know, it's unresponsive to treatment or it's a really unusual case, get sent on to subspecialty care. And then we're trained in a lot of procedures, you know, everything from wart freezings to contraceptive procedures, intrauterine device insertions, vasectomies, those types of things, joint injections, pretty much all office-based stuff. And then some will get additional training. We have, there's family physicians who continue to do deliveries, even by C-section, endoscopies, those types of things. So there's a pretty wide range that they'll take things out to.
Do primary care physicians play a role in preventing infertility caused by lifestyle factors, STIs, that sort of thing?
Lots of the things that may negatively affect fertility are common habits that should be assessed anyway, even before you get to an infertility point. So, you know, tobacco smoking is a big one. Looking at tobacco smokers, if you're smoking more than 10 cigarettes a day, that's very well known to negatively affect fertility rates. So talk to folks about smoking cessation. We can institute medications. We can assist with counseling, those types of things. And a lot of people are maybe not be aware that, well, they don't want to quit smoking, so they're just going to go on with infertility treatments. But smoking will continue to affect success rates for advanced reproductive therapies as well. So tobacco is a huge one. Optimal weight, a big one for fertility, not just obesity, but also underweight. So a BMI, you know, ideally, if you get above a BMI, body mass index, sorry, try not to speak in too much jargon, but if your body mass index is above 27, then that's going to have a negative impact on fertility, as well as a body mass index of under 17. So you don't want to weigh too little because that can affect ovulation patterns. So counseling people about weight loss or weight gain in some cases is really important. And then looking at other elements of people's lifestyle. So excessive exercise can cause some infertility. So if people are exercising more than 5 hours a day, they'll need some counseling about that. Exercise is great, but there's such thing as too much of a good thing. So making sure people are aware of certain things like that. Alcohol, you know, moderate or less alcohol intake is not a significant factor for infertility, but excessive alcohol intake certainly can be. And so counseling people on what moderate intake is. So for a woman, that's about 7 drinks a week. And don't save all those drinks for the same Saturday night. But the big thing about alcohol is if you are actively trying to conceive, we don't know that there's a safe range of alcohol exposure, particularly around the time of conception and early first trimester. So a very careful assessment of alcohol intake and making sure people are aware that the safest thing is alcohol avoidance around that time. You mentioned screening for sexually transmitted infections. So absolutely. Women often don't have a lot of symptoms if they have, a gonorrhea or chlamydia. And so certainly screening the high-risk women, which is basically sexually active women up to age 26, and then assessing factors because just because you're over 26 doesn't mean you're outside the risk window for sexually transmitted infections. Those are probably the big things that really ought to be assessed, and ideally even before attempts at conception start occurring.
I assume you guys don't only focus on women. Obviously, the male is involved in producing a child as well. So do you also help in the prevention on that side?
Yes, although, you know, men just kind of generally have it easier than women in a lot of things. So definitely they can still be affected. So smoking, particularly smoking, can decrease the quality of sperm in the semen. So yes, we counsel men about that too. Less evidence that the rest of those things have significant impact for male fertility. But one of the big things is, and we'll probably get to this later, but it's always great to have both man and woman in the room at the same time, because it's a much more efficient way. And when both people are in the same room, you tend not to forget, because as you alluded to, sometimes the male factor of infertility is ignored a bit.
When should you see your primary care doctor about possible infertility?
The short answer is as soon as you have any concern. And ideally, I think a really highly functioning primary care practice will make that part of an initial visit or a periodic health review is for people in their reproductive age, making sure you've assessed factors that can negatively impact reproduction before there's a diagnosis of infertility. So review recommendations, make sure women know they'll be taking folate. The big thing is identifying comorbid diseases that can be addressed before attempts at conception occur. I guess a good example, recently I had a woman who was 23, came in, and she was concerned because she'd been trying to conceive for 4 months and had not had success yet. I was able to reassure her, say, you know, we reviewed her health history. She was healthy, didn't have any risk factors, and was up to date on all her screening stuff. And I just said, hey, look, just keep doing what you're doing. And there's basically a 90% chance that you will have success conceiving before the end of the 12 calendar months. And sure enough, shortly after that discussion, she was pregnant. And to make sure that people are aware of when to come in. So 12 months for women under 35 who have been having attempts at conception without success. Make sure that they know at the 12-month mark, it's time to come in. If they're above age 35, 6 months, it's time to come in. And a really careful assessment of if you know you have had pelvic inflammatory disease previously or you had an ectopic pregnancy previously, you know you have hypothyroidism, you know you have polycystic ovarian syndrome, you know, I would strongly recommend going in again before or simultaneously with attempts to conceive.
Do you ever do preconception appointments? I'm not sure if that's a regular thing, but I know I had one before we started trying.
I do. So I try to work in preconception with any wellness visit of people in reproductive ages. So because that's such a big part of life then. And so I often won't do a specific preconception visit, but when they're in for a wellness exam for whatever reason, or it's their initial exam with the practice, absolutely incorporate reviewing what their plans for conception are, if they are planning to start having, you know, trying for a baby soon. And we review those things, folate supplementation. If they are saying, yes, we're ready to start trying for a baby, talking about timing of intercourse, those kinds of things. So yeah, I think preconception is really important. I think it should just be integrated in somebody's routine primary care. And that's how I try to approach it.
What information should you have available to share with your doctor as you begin to talk about infertility?
One of the biggest things is really having a good appreciation for your own health history. So you'd be surprised the number of times people come in and they say, yeah, I kind of had hypothyroidism, but I quit following up on it and I don't know where I am. So understanding your own health history, whether you have chronic medical problems, if you've had prior surgeries, particularly gynecologic surgeries, when those occurred, who did them? Because sometimes researching that can be important when you're approaching an infertility evaluation. And then reviewing, you know, when was your last pap smear? Do you know about folate? Those kinds of things. Next biggest thing is menstrual history. So you like to know when the onset of, you know, your first periods were in your life. Certainly the pattern for the last 12 months is really important. You know, are you having periods every 4 weeks? You know, how heavy is the flow? Is there a lot of pain with it? Are there any other associated symptoms from constipation to pain with intercourse? Those kinds of things can all give clues about whether there's an underlying problem. I do like to get into, you know, what I call a sex history and make sure that the couples are timing intercourse for optimal chances at conception. So, you know, 5 days before the onset of ovulation or the day of ovulation, and making sure they're not having any difficulty, pain with intercourse, erectile dysfunction, those types of things. And then finally, just, you know, ask if they're using any ovulation prediction techniques. So if they are bringing their basal body temperature rates, or if they've been using a LH kit over the counter, then bring those in as well. And then the other thing I always like to talk about is I've got written in my notes, deployments. In the military, it's common for deployments to occur. So people are separated for a few to several months, even sometimes a year and a half. And bringing that information in when you come in to talk about infertility be really important, because that may affect timing of workup. You may do things a lot sooner than you would otherwise. And you know, that's common in the military, but certainly not unique. Other companies may have separation. So any social situation where the opportunity for intercourse isn't going to be there is important to know.
Do you have tips about communicating with your primary doctor about infertility concerns?
One thing that can help maximize a visit is making sure there's clear communication ahead of time about what the appointment is for. So when you make the appointment, make sure that the staff or whoever is arranging the appointment is clear that the visit is for infertility, and try to have your own information, the information we just discussed, at the ready for discussion when you see the doc. But and when you start the appointment with the physician, make sure that they're clear that this is a visit for infertility, because visits can get easily sidetracked and then time is up and you haven't really gotten your concerns addressed. You know, if speaking about sex history, menstruation, that kind of stuff is uncomfortable for you, kind of psychologically prepare yourself, because the more frankly and openly you can speak about that, the better information the doc will get and the better evaluation you're going to get from that. And also get a good sense of what the physician's comfort level is in terms of executing a diagnostic evaluation and what their referral patterns are. So knowing that is going to be important for you. And then be clear with the doc as what your expectations are. I mean, if you're feeling like you're really in a hurry, be sure that that is communicated clearly. The better a physician understands what your expectations are, honestly, that they're going to adjust their approach to helping you accordingly.
This is a problem that I see quite often, so I'm interested to hear your answer for sure. How can you engage with your doctor when you don't feel like your concerns are being taken seriously?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I do think there is an intimidation factor when people visit a physician. The physician is often seen as in a position of authority and should be. I mean, you're coming to that physician for their expertise, but that can also create some intimidation about asking questions. And if you feel like you're not getting your questions addressed, just it may be hard to do, but just be direct in your communication and say, hey, look, this is not what I was looking for. And you're not meeting the expectations I have when I came in here. So how can we work through that? One thing that can be really helpful is getting a specific commitment from your doctor about what he or she is willing to do in terms of a workup and at what point they would be more likely to refer. And that's going to vary widely from your clinic situation. If you are in a kind of a traditional big health system primary care clinic, they are often pretty fast paced. And, you know, the average time of speaking to the physician is about 7 to 11 minutes if you're lucky. So you may, that type of clinic is probably going to not want to talk to you a whole lot about things and probably send off referrals early versus, a private practice clinic. That operates a little bit differently, may have a lot more time to spend with you. So knowing that is helpful. And so you might, coming back to how does it help communicate, gauging your own expectations and when to just kind of cut bait. And obviously being clear with your own expectations about how you want things to proceed. You know, if you are, again, in a hurry or you really don't want to spend much time with the primary care doc, you'd rather just be referred, make sure that's explicit. My opinion is physicians shouldn't be offended or upset if you say, hey, I just want to move on to the reproductive endocrinologist. That should be okay.
I have a question that might not have an answer, but what do you do when a doctor is telling you that there isn't a problem and you don't really know otherwise? I'll give you an example. I have endometriosis, but I went for 12 years without knowing that. I saw a family physician until I went away to college. I had debilitating pain, bleeding like you would not believe. I would, you know, they say more than I've had an hour is something to be concerned about. I know that now, but I was having more than an overnight pad every 30 minutes and heavy clotting, again, debilitating pain. And I had a doctor who told me that that was totally normal to suck it up. That's just how periods are. And how am I to know any different? So being raised in a society and a culture where we're told that the doctor is always the expert and you are not, what do you do in that situation?
That's a really good question, because you don't know what you don't know, right? From the physician's perspective, a history of what you just described is clearly abnormal, and red flags for endometriosis all over the place. So it's frustrating that you had that experience. I think the best answer I can give you is if you, in your heart of hearts, you're just like, this is not normal. Or you've talked to other people and they're like, holy cow, we don't have that kind of problem. And your doctor is saying everything's fine. Get a second opinion. Because if you keep going back to the same person, I think you're probably going to keep getting the same answer. And you very well may be missing something that may be relatively easy to address. You may get, sometimes you may ask questions and the doc, particularly in a primary care clinic, they'll say, well, I'll get back to you and we'll figure it out. And that's okay. Primary care, generally, family medicine specifically, it's a very broad specialty and you can't keep everything at the top of your head. So I would say take that answer initially, but also get a commitment about, you know, when I'll get back to you is going to be. And if it's 2 weeks or 2 months, you know, that might not be acceptable. But if they say, hey, I just need a day or two to refresh on where we're going to go with this, I would certainly accept that because I do still think there's tremendous value in continuity of care up to the point where you've exhausted that physician's level of expertise. Hopefully that, I don't know how well that answered that question, but.
It did. It did. I actually saw many, many, many doctors before I ended up getting a diagnosis. And it was only because I was open up on the table for a different reason, and they found endometriosis all inside my body.
Oh, so you had an actual
laparoscopy.
Intraoperative diagnosis. That's
I did. I did.
And technically, yes. That's the only way to absolutely diagnose it, but certainly you had classic signs of it. Sorry that happened. It really, if you'd seen more than one doctor, it really shouldn't happen. But.
I, of course, didn't have too many choices before I was out from under my parents' roof. But as I got older, I saw many more doctors and was always dismissed, was always told that I was just being a real wimp about it. So, and I didn't know any better. My parents didn't know what to do with me when I was in high school. And although no one else seemed to be having this experience, I had tons of doctors just telling me that, like, this is how it is. So I eventually just let it drop because I was convinced that that was just how it was. So yeah, it was a real surprise when I woke up from that surgery and they were like, yeah, so you have endometriosis.
That's frustrating to hear because, I mean, like I said, you can't absolutely diagnose it unless you do a laparoscopy, but you can certainly make with classic symptoms and you can treat for it. And if it responds and you know, sometimes it always doesn't always help with infertility specifically, but certainly with the other symptoms. So I'm sorry on behalf of my profession that we failed you for that long.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. So speaking of symptoms and everything, what kind of fertility workup can you expect from your primary care doctor in particular?
For what workup should you expect for both sides of the equation? I'll put in a little plug for convenience of family medicine if you got a good clinic to go to. You know, in my clinic, I encourage people to bring their partners at the time. They can bring the whole gang if there's already children involved. So, you know, we'll entertain the kids while we talk to the couples. But I think it's really important to talk to the couples at the same time, if at all possible. It can help suss out problems with relationships. You know, you can have pretty frank discussions about timing of intercourse and those kinds of things. And you can establish the concept that, hey, we're going to have to work up both folks for this as we go along. And I actually encourage people to do the male factor part early on in the assessment. But first things first, the big thing is, and hopefully this has already been done, but if it hasn't, this is absolutely the time to do it. I review to make sure there's not other disease states that are causing this. So, you know, hypothyroidism, endometriosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, things that can be addressed, at least to a certain extent, by your primary care physician to relieve that part of things. If there aren't any factors, you know, there's haven't identified sexually transmitted infections. Everybody's up to date on everything. And there's no existing disease states that might be impacting things. Then you move on to some initial lab testing. And this is stuff that's really very easily done and probably more cheaply done in the primary care office. So a complete blood count, a comprehensive metabolic panel that looks for liver, kidney function. I almost reflexively include thyroid testing to make sure that that's not a problem. If there's an indication for sexually transmitted infection testing, absolutely do that. And then I had the discussion, hey, let's consider at least going ahead and doing a semen analysis at that time. So that's kind of the initial set of labs that I'll send off and then make decisions based on that. once that has come back, if everything is normal, then you can look at, you know, assessing ovulation function in ovarian reserve. So progressing to luteal phase progesterone testing, you could sometimes will incorporate the over-the-counter LH testing to see if ovulation is occurring. And then you can consider doing, you know, a day three follicular stimulating hormone test or even anti-Müllerian hormone tests. And then all a discussion about when to do radiological assessment for anatomic function. So totally reasonable, I think, in your primary care physician's office to do order all those things as indicated, and also a hysterosalpingogram. So a contrast radiology study with x-rays that shoots dye and makes sure there's patency all the way from the cervix to the through the fallopian tubes.
I'm glad to hear that you do thyroid testing as a routine. I feel like that's missed a lot.
Interesting. Your experiences in seeing that kind of stuff actually surprised me because it is thyroid disease is quite common, and I assess that for lots of different things, not just infertility. So yeah, that's like I said, that's pretty much a reflexive early on test that I do. And the male factor too. It's a simple, inexpensive test. And, you know, if everything's fine, then you've eliminated that part. Often things aren't fine. So it's often a kind of a multifactorial findings. So maybe a little bit low sperm count or morphology's off a little bit. And then you can talk about lifestyle things that the male is doing in terms of, you know, underwear, hot tub use, alcohol use, smoking, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, for the thyroid, that one actually wasn't me. I am an infertility coach outside of this podcast. Mm-hmm, yeah. That's my paying gig.
Right.
And so I see people's complete medical records often. Mm-hmm. That's what I am doing all the time. Yeah. And I rarely see thyroid as a test that is included, even done by the fertility doctor.
Really?
Yeah, it surprises me. And like you said, it is very common. And so I will work with people and they will be shocked to learn that they have a thyroid condition.
Yeah, I'm shocked that you see that often, particularly from fertility specialists. Surprised.
I'm actually talking to someone right after this interview about thyroid results. And yes, her being in shock that her doctor wasn't all that concerned despite having high levels. So yeah, we just need to apparently clone you and put you all over the country because we are being failed by our doctors in a lot of respects. I don't mean to be so down on doctors, but this does happen apparently quite often.
No, that's okay. And I it's fair. I mean, if we're missing things, we should know about it. And the nice thing about modern times is there's so much you can find out online. That's a double-edged sword, obviously, because, you know, if you go see Dr. Google, you may come back with cancer for having the sniffles. But there is still a lot of reliable information out there. And I, you know, one of the big things I do is I encourage my patients, if they've been looking at something, please bring that to my attention. My system of care makes it really easy for patients to send me information, not just in a visit. They can send me stuff electronically and I'll review it and get back to them on it. So I would argue that if you have, you know, even just normal levels of intelligence and a computer with an internet access, you can kind of double check on what your physician's doing. And I encourage people to do just that.
You mentioned this briefly, but of course, infertility gets expensive the longer you're doing it. So what is the estimated cost of a fertility workup? And are there any opportunities there to save money?
So difficult to say. So I don't treat infertility myself, and I'm comfortable certainly doing a workup to, like I said, testing ovarian reserve and doing an anatomic survey. But I don't test or treat beyond that. So hard to give an estimate for any individual's full infertility workup, and it's going to be idiosyncratic to them anyway, obviously. For the testing that I described to you just now, I actually calculated this up before we started the podcast. The labs for that, from my practice, for both women and men, so the semen analysis and all the lab tests that I described to you, would be $210. And then the HSG we can get for about $425, $435. So that initial workup through a primary, you know, that I think is a good basic one to do through your primary care doc would be, what is that, $650.
You mentioned that you don't treat infertility, but do primary care physicians anywhere treat it?
Sure. You know, there's very little. I didn't get to this when you asked me about what family medicine docs are trained to do. We do get a lot of training in obstetrics and gynecology. So delivered close to 100 babies before I left residency. I was comfortable on labor and delivery, comfortable doing a lot of basic office gynecology, but we don't get much specific infertility training, particularly in terms of treatment, more training in terms of recognition and evaluation, but treatment, no. So a family physician or internal medicine doc, I don't know about pediatricians who are going to be embarking on treating infertility, would have to probably seek out additional training. And there is elective time in a residency where you could reasonably get to certain level of expertise with infertility. So I think if you see a primary care physician doing things, it'll probably be limited to ovulation induction with clomiphene, or maybe as advanced as intrauterine insemination. I have talked to some folks who do that. If your primary care physician is offering you infertility treatment, I would just be very clear on what their expertise level is. You know, how did you get trained to do that? How often do you do this? Because if they do it every once in a blue moon, you know, it's probably not the best choice. But if they say, hey, I'm very consciously made this a part of my training in residency, and I have consciously made sure that I have stayed up on currency with doing these procedures, then you may save a good bit of money doing it through your primary care doc. That would be my advice there. And going back a little bit to the cost discussion, whoever's doing your evaluation and or treatment, look at the venue in which you're doing it. So if you're doing it in an office-based setting, that's going to be cheaper than a hospital setting. So if you're going to need any surgical treatments, an ambulatory surgical, you know, if you're getting surgery for endometriosis, doing something that is a relatively, you know, it's not an emergency high-risk surgery, doing those in an ambulatory surgery center are always going to be cheaper than doing it in a hospital setting. And your physician may not even be aware of that fact. I'm routinely surprised at the lack of knowledge that physicians have about the cost of the treatments they're implementing and how they can themselves, just by signing the right piece of paper, can make things a lot less expensive. So always ask. And I strongly encourage patients to ask about cost every time. Hey, you're doing this. What is this going to cost me? And if you can't get a specific answer, strongly consider getting a second opinion about from somewhere who can. I have to think that infertility specialists are probably already fairly attuned to this because it's not very often covered in a given insurance plan. I would think an infertility specialty or an infertility clinic would be fairly already pretty savvy about that, but I don't know that for sure.
OBGYNs can receive a board certification in reproductive endocrinology and infertility, but I'm curious about family physicians. Where do you get access to training with regard to Clomid cycles and IUIs? Is that something you have access to?
And it's going to vary from training program to training program. Part of our rotations are that we rotate specifically through, you know, we have 3 or 4 months rotating with obstetricians and gynecologists who train us on that. And then we take that back and incorporate it into our clinic practice under the supervision of similarly trained family physicians. So it's like I mentioned that it was something you have to be consciously seek out and say, go to your attending physicians and say, hey, I'm really interested in this. Will you teach me how to do this? And then you mentioned, I don't think family physicians or primary care physicians generally can sit for reproductive endocrinology boards, although I'm not certain of that offhand. My suspicion is no. But when hospitals credential you, so they review your training and your currency and will say, yes, you're okay to do this. And so you can get the training and not be discriminated against just based on specialty. But those are good, you know, those, like I said, those are questions you want to ask if you're not having it done by a reproductive endocrinologist to say, hey, prove your competency to me.
This is a very, very specific question, but at a fertility clinic, when you do an IUI, they wash the sperm. Is that something that could even be done with your primary care?
Not mine in particular. So you'd be surprised. Equipment to purchase things like that, and I'm not speaking specifically of washing semen for that particular purpose, but sometimes the equipment really isn't very difficult. You can get it, or you can have a lab do it. I don't do it, and I don't have enough expertise with the procedure to tell you how expensive it would be. But if you have the right equipment, then there's no reason you can't do it.
You mentioned this at the very top of our interview, but I didn't know if there's anything else you wanted to add here. At what point should patients be requesting a referral to a fertility specialist?
I think that is 100% individualized to the patient. And I think the simplest answer is as soon as you want one. If you don't, if you don't have much trust in your primary care doc, then you should not be pursuing treatment for any reason. But if it's maybe a specific trust level for infertility, you ask for the referral at that time. Just say, hey, I want to go out. If you do have a good level of trust, then say, hey, at what point are you going to refer me out, and make sure that sits well with what you want as well. And then if there's any time where, you know, you feel like your answers aren't being met, your concerns aren't being taken seriously, say, hey, I think this is time for me to go seek expert care.
So the 1 year rule for under 35 and the 6 month rule for over 35, how hard and fast are those guidelines? Because I think a lot of people in this community become frustrated by them, thinking that, okay, I've hit the 1 year and one day mark, I can finally get the show on the road, even though time is obviously of the utmost importance.
Honestly, I think that more often boils down to payment. And so if your insurance or whatever plan you're using for payment isn't going to pay to that point, that often is what plays into it. I personally strongly believe that, hey, if there's high risk factors, so let's say we have a 23-year-old who doesn't have any chronic medical problems, but had a bad episode of pelvic inflammatory disease, comes in and it's been 3 or 4 months and they haven't conceived, I would be very quick to pull the trigger on a referral out for, you know, expert level infertility care for that person. So I think, yeah, you should not be held to that. I think you're seeking expert care should not be based on something relatively arbitrary like those things, and that you should be able to go when you want to. But payment often comes into that.
Sure. And insurance is definitely a fair point. I know a lot of people often lie about how long they've been trying, because how is the insurance going to verify that?
That's an excellent point. Yeah.
Do primary care physicians ever work in coordination with fertility specialists after that referral? Is there ever a back and forth at all?
I would hope so. Certainly when I refer folks out, I track the referrals very carefully. And if I haven't gotten communication on the results of that referral in what I think is a timely manner, I'm on the phone to track those down. And I think there could be some really good cooperation if infertility specialist catches something that the doc missed that can still be handled in that office. That would be a great thing and probably a cost savings thing. One thing I really like to do is, because my labs tend to be a lot less expensive than if you order them through a big health system, I tell my patients, hey, get the list of labs and let me know, and we can maybe run them through my practice and they'll be less expensive for you. So there's something that's just as practical as that level of coordination.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't already talked about?
I think we've covered everything that I would expect someone to take in and hopefully utilize their primary care physician for. I think I'll just maybe reinforce being your own advocate, and from anything in terms of having your concerns addressed appropriately and having adequate answers that you can understand about what might be causing infertility. And being an advocate for yourself on cost, ask what things cost, ask if you can do it cheaper, ask if there's a venue in which it can be done cheaper. And if you're not getting straight answers, encourage you to look for people who can give you straight answers.
To wrap up the episode, what words of hope would you offer to a woman or a couple or a man who is just starting on their infertility journey right now?
Probably the hardest thing to do, and that's have patience. Often things take some time to work themselves out. Often evaluations that are going to be done correctly and effectively are going to take some time. And don't ever lose hope. My own personal story with infertility is my brother and his wife had a baby early on in their marriage and were planning to have more children, but ran into infertility with their second child. And they had a lot of evaluation, and there was multifactorial aspects to it, and they eventually decided they weren't going to pursue past a certain level. And then a few years later, they got pregnant. Just happens. So I would just say, don't give up hope.
Dr. Holgren, thank you for coming on the show today. I appreciate it. Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.